Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Today on the show, we explore a surprising question. What if the things we assume will last forever, like our photos, emails, social media accounts, and family records, are actually far more fragile than we realize? Our guest this morning is Thomas Mullaney. He's a Stanford historian who studies technology, information, and memory. In his new book, How We Disappear, Mullaney challenges the myth of digital permanence and explains why preserving our stories, relationships, and legacies takes more than simply saving them. It requires intention, context, and care. Thomas Mullaney, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
It's great to be back. Thank you for having me back.
Wonderful to have you. Last time we spoke to you a couple years ago, we were talking to you about the history of the Chinese typewriter.
That's right.
I remember at the time thinking, this is something I never would have thought about if it weren't for Tom Mullaney bringing it to our attention, which is a really wonderful thing. So let me start with this. This particular topic has a little more, let's say, personal application for you. Is that not correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, I sort of wrote myself a self-help book to come to terms with the disappearance of everything, and then along the way wrote a book for others as well. So it was a process of really coming to terms with basically the second law of thermodynamics. We learned it in school, but it's time to face the facts and actually ask the implications of this.
So I think that, you know, many people, like politicians, for example, running for office who did really dumb things in their 20s or in college, they would say, and this is the assumption that you challenge, is that, you know, on the internet, nothing ever disappears. Mm. But you're going to say that it does. And how so?
Well, the first and, you know, the basic premise, and it's not revolutionary. We've known it for centuries now, is that the universe has been entropically, let's call it, you know, tending towards heat death since the moment of its creation, that life and anything that put this universe in order, whether that's, you know, cellular, molecular, let alone, this is billions of years later. So everything disappears because every arrangement or organization putting into formation anything is basically happening in a vast falling elevator of a universe that is really allergic to order and things. So the digital age is no exception to that. It basically, though, it kind of changes a little bit of the particular highway that we take to the same destination. The destination is the same, which is the disappearance of all things, the breakdown of all order. But the digital age and every new technology really kind of sometimes adds a new pathway by which that disappearance happens. So simply put, an MP3 file or a JPEG disappears differently than a printed photograph. But make no mistake, they're both on the pathway, on the highway to disappearance. But, you know, the billboards along the way are slightly different.
Right. Well, this is just so interesting. It does make me think back to the time. Remember when we switched from a film cartridge that you would put in your camera to that memory card?
Mm-hmm.
Your book made me think about that very thing, about how you would take these memory cards out. Well, you're storing them where? Or,
right,
you know, for when in your life.
Right.
And I've gone back to those memory cards and they're corrupted. They don't work anymore. And
right.
So this is probably the sort of thing, among many others, that you're warning about in your book.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about, I don't know, like if you were to find a photograph in your, you know, in a shoebox under a bed from the 1970s, you know, no big deal. That is what we would call naked eye readable. You could actually see it. Now, it is degrading. The colors are fading. The paper is acidifying. It is on its own pathway towards kind of decomposing. You find a floppy disk from the 80s, and you will need a system that can load that. You'll need the same operating system and programs that could read it. The file formats, the .jpegs, the ., which is a constantly moving target, is then an issue. And then, as you noted, magnetic media, whether it's floppy disks or cassette disks, even things like non-magnetic media like DVDs, are among the most fragile and short-lived of media. So basically the digital age is like one sinking boat after another, and you just constantly have to be getting life rafts and bringing all of the passengers to flee one sinking Titanic onto another sinking Titanic onto another sinking Titanic. But the digital age is about, you have a migration imperative. You can never hang out for too long in any one medium. And that's different. That's not the same as, parchment books. It's a different story.
Yes. And in many ways, as you say, much more vulnerable. And I've never even thought about that until now. You start the book off by talking about, losing your parents eventually, and your father has a stroke, and that's where the story begins. Since then, how have you dealt with restoring what remains? And at what point did you say, wow, this is really actually quite a crisis that we have going on, that I need to reconstruct this life, these lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. There's sort of two timelines to the book, which I think is always true of every book that's ever been written. There's the timeline of the book that the book itself suggests, so in this case, I've had people ask me or imagine that I kind of started writing this book when my father died, which in a certain sense is true, but in a broader span, the book began about 24 years ago. There's a episode in the book I talk about of being in grad school at Columbia and sort of hitting me like an epiphany that the process by which all of my work on my dissertation could come crashing down, and not something like a conflagration, a fire in my apartment, nothing so dramatic. If I were to have misplaced 20 of my index cards, then the entire edifice of my dissertation and therefore my career would have come down. So I started to contemplate the ways at that point in my life, the ways in which things fall apart undramatically. So no book burnings, not genocide, not colonial devastation, not this museum or that museum because of an electrical fire going up in smoke, but just the drifty, leaky ways that books fall out of print, I worked on the book sort of in secret for I guess 2 decades, and it was a very, it's a book about everything. It's chemistry, it's physics, it's history, it's memory, it's cognitive science, and so it became a little bit like a ridiculous and impossible obsession. And meanwhile, I wrote the Chinese typewriter, I wrote the Chinese computer, I was working on other things. And for a long time, I just thought I would never actually really write this. And when my father passed away and just sort of being in his room, it's not as if I got out my notebook and started writing, but I think something started there of, it all came home. It all came home. And so once I had gone through probably the first few months of mourning and shock, and just, I was also becoming a father right around that time, and just the joyous shock of becoming a father, I think that's when I sat down and made a decision, which I was not planning on doing, that maybe this is a more personal story, and maybe this is the way to bring these threads together. But it's really, I like to think of the book as one that does have some practical advice, but I really want to come back to this point of, and anyone that reads the book will see it. Above all, I really invite the reader to know that life is this strange mixture where you're never actually going to save this stuff. But at the same time, you can't be okay. You can't be too okay with that fact. You've got to live in the myth that you could save all this stuff, but not go so far in the myth where you are literally contravening the basic laws of physics, which, sorry, that's the ball game.
Wow. My son, who's now 28, was about 7 or 8 when he called me and sang me this Christmas carol. It was the cutest thing ever. And then I switched carriers. I saved that message forever. And I should know this because I know about saving files. I didn't save it. I just thought all of that information transferred. To this day, you know, 20 years later, it aches right here in my heart that that song is no longer there.
And it wasn't something, you know, it's switching carriers, this most mundane of things. It's those kinds of mundane parts of the story that kind of fascinate and haunt me the most.
Oh, it is haunting. And to follow up, I stuck with the new carrier for about 2 weeks until I noticed it dropped all my calls, went back to the original carrier. It just makes me sick. But, you know, we have those. And, you know, currently on my phone, I have all of these saved messages from my mother, who is still thriving at 87 years old. But, you know, I need to transfer them somewhere where they're going to last. And so, oh, gosh, what's number one advice for that sort of situation?
Well, a little goes a long way. So, you know, I as much as I write about these things, I don't want to pretend as if I am a great archivist. I'm not. I mean, my wife does a much, much better job, I would say, so we do, I know enough about archival stuff. We buy acid-free boxes. There's this incredible company, Gaylord Archive, you know, so they cost a little bit more, but they last a lot longer. So they have, unlike the photo albums you get at like Mike's Camera or something, these are, you know, non-reactive. Little things like that make a difference, you know, that $10 Amazon photo album versus that $20 one from Gaylord Archives, you know, go with the latter, because that first one is literally eating your photographs as if it contains various kinds of chemical compounds or VOCs or things like that. It's silly, but, you know, well, we're an earthquake country, of course. So we need, when we frame pictures and we put them on the wall, we swap out the glass panels for kind of acrylic. And again, there you can get ones that are UV resistant. And so that makes a huge difference in terms of, I mean, I've gone to my brother's house and seen photographs from when he visited me in China when I was studying abroad. And they look like they're from the Civil War, you know, these photographs do. And they're just on the hallway. Now here's the thing, is for my brother, for me, you know, I have plenty of unsleeved, unframed, unprotected photographs on my wall. I'm looking at my son, my two sons, my brother-in-law. I'm looking at my wife right now as we talk. We need to remember that the first and most important thing that these photographs do is serve us in our life. That's their purpose, you know. That's why I talk about this in the book. That's why I don't label them. I don't, you know, I don't flip them over and write the year and the full legal name of everybody. Because, you know, the first job of everything we do in life is just to get through the day, to get through our lives, to put it together, to be on time, to get the kids out the door. And it turns out that putting a life together and then putting history together are actually at odds. They are antagonistic most of the time. Labeling photographs has no value in the, you know, to get me to my office in time, to get me to not miss a flight or something like that. But then, you know, things happen and suddenly and very rapidly, and that's what death to me is, a death in the family or something like that. It's not the beginning of the disappearance process, that's already in place, but it kind of like suddenly accelerates everything. And all of those shortcuts that we take through life, you know, prioritizing life over posterity, just boom, come into focus. But a single acid-free file folder marked 2026. But no organization, just basically the file folder equivalent of a junk drawer in your kitchen is great. Because for me as an archival historian, if I come across someone's papers 150 years later and I find that file folder that says these are from 2026, then I am so much better off as the historian trying to reconstruct the past, where I'm like, well, unless someone is lying to me, everything in this file folder is in some way, shape, or form connected to this particular year. And then I'm off to the races. I can do a lot of, it's my profession. I can put other pieces together if I have that one clue. So a little bit goes a long way. I told one other person, take a family photo, bring it to, FedEx or Kinko's, make a color photocopy, and then just literally with a magic marker, circle people's faces and just draw a line and be like, this is grandma and write out her name. This is dad, write out his name. And then just tuck that in the back of the photo album. And a person 100 years from now, we're all little pattern recognition machines. We'll figure out, like, oh, that face is that person. This looks like a young version of that person. And we can reconstruct a lot of it. But no one ever bothers to make that key to the map. And of course, why would we? But a little bit goes a long way.
Yeah, great point. If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation with Thomas Mullaney. He has written a new book called How We Disappear, which at first glance feels like it's, we want to disappear. We want all these things from our past to disappear. And it's not that guide. It is not that how-to. It is how to preserve and remember. Well, as you said a few moments ago, that this book is about so many different things. So we can talk about technology and digitization and all of that, but so much of it is also just about relationship and relationship, special moments that we hold throughout our lives and how we need to remember those, and why something like losing the Christmas carol that your son sang to you over the phone is so devastating is because, yeah, memories and relationships are important. So what do you say in the book about that as it relates to all this other stuff?
That's basically the context is what goes first. So the photographs last, and of course, if you worked for the CIA and you did find that floppy drive, the CIA could probably bring back to life that SD card that you mentioned before. But you need like $1 million and you need a reason to do it. But yeah, you could probably excavate those pictures from that dead media if you had the firepower to do it. But for the average, for the rest of us, what tends to go first is not the physical object that is the source of a memory. It is really the relationship between all of these different objects, the context of it. And I think that we can do a lot more in our lives and make that context maybe a bit more of our everyday life. Like the number of photo albums, growing up, I was the one, like I talk about in the book, I found this luggage that was just shoved with all of these unlabeled photographs. And I was like, well, I'll put them at least into an album. But I'll have to say that it pretty much sat there on the shelf. We never had like a family tradition of, okay, it's Thanksgiving, let's go on the couch and go through the album. And unless you take, life is in the living. Unless you take that thing out and have a conversation about it or integrate it into the day-to-day life, it doesn't remember itself. You got to go to the gym of memory, just like you got to go to the gym of gy the gym. It doesn't, just because you bought a a Peloton, you're not going to, your muscles won't tone themselves just by having that photo album on the wall. I have to practice what I preach in our own life because it's life is just so crazy. Just getting through the week is so crazy, and I agree with many that it just feels like it's getting more intense. Just with each passing year, it's hard to carve out that time where the only purpose of this is to keep the beach ball of memory, up. integrating it, that context into the everyday life is what I'm trying to think through now.
Well, it sounds like you're an advocate for taking our digital memories and printing them, because you've talked a lot about photo albums and back to Gaylord archives and how to keep, and it's so interesting because we went from this time way back when where we had film and we got prints, physical prints. And then we moved over into the digital age and we thought that was so advanced. We'll have these forever. But now it's sounding like you're kind of suggesting going the opposite way and taking the digitization and having physical prints.
That can help. I mean, I think, this is a nice opportunity. I'm going to try to succinctly put my strategy, for if I were going to advise someone, what I would advise a family, a person to do is you can't save it all. Don't give in to that fiction. And so then the question becomes, what do you save? And for me, and I'll say this as an historian, I've worked in 20 archives, no, I'm sorry, 20 countries and over 100 archives. What I know lights me up and lights my colleagues up is paradox, is sort of contradictions. It's kind of noise in the system. And what I mean by that is there are people that want to preserve a particular story about themselves, like I want the world to, I want to put myself in a bust in a museum, and I want people to read my tombstone or my and I want to control this vision of yourself. And it's a very seductive idea, and yet it is probably something that accelerates a person's disappearance faster than anything, because the moment that a person becomes a statue, figuratively or literally, they lose all of their humanity. They lose the fundamental thing that makes humans humans, which humans don't add up to one. We're paradoxical, we're contradictory. And so what I would say is, if you're going to sit down and have a strategy for, all things being equal, we can't save everything. Save a subset of these traces that contradict each other, that sort of are the elements of a human being. Where I did a study of this guy in my Chinese computer book, an amazing guy. He was an electrical engineer. He worked under the towering figures of electrical engineering, and he also like moonlighted and sang in like a Christmas choir. So it's deeply serious, like apparently very, very rigorous with the students, and then had this kind of like frivolity and this other side. Preserve those weird combinations of things, because when the person is gone, the posterity has a higher chance of being curious about them, of actually going like, this woman did not add up to one. Like I wonder about this, and I wonder about this, and that old questions is what keeps a person's alive. Just perfect airtight narratives and statues don't, because there's nothing human about them. So I think preserving that paradox of a person, an institution, a place, is actually has the greatest chance of keeping a legacy alive in the form of questions.
Wow, that lends so much to this notion of when you read a history book and it is a chronology and it's so darn boring. I'm sure you, as a
Yes, it
historian,
is.
can do it. I cannot. But when you get the stories and, like you say, the paradox and the contradiction, that's when it pulls you in. So, what a wonderful thing to do with memories, with photos.
I mean, we're complicit, and I have a whole, section of the book where I say that I think I call it we're sentenced to death. And that is, people in my profession, guilty. We are the guiltiest of all of basically denuding the historical landscape of, so, we don't ever talk about how someone's breath smelled. We don't ever talk about, did they favor their left leg over their right? Were all their teeth straight? Did they have a Brooklyn accent? Do we kind of get to the point, and we, and so that, that's, it's not as if when you capture something in writing that you have captured it. It's another part in the process of how things disappear. And yeah, but if you tried to get that book published, where you talked about, what did Benjamin Franklin's breath smell like? What were the alignment of every one of his teeth? Which hairs grayed first? Your editor would say, "Aren't you writing about the, Revolutionary War period? Like, aren't you writing about the founding of the nation? Like, get to the point." And in fact, many readers would as well. But so that's this dance. But we are absolutely complicit in accelerating the disappearance of the very thing that we write histories about. 99.9 repeating percent of the time.
Yeah. Wow. The book is How We Disappear, A Personal History of Information. Thomas Mullaney is my guest. Tom, thank you so much for joining us again here on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you again for having me.